it gives me the greatest of pleasures to introduce one of my very good friends, Miss Christy.
Hello, Christy.
Hi. I am Christy, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Christy.
My sobriety date is January 28th, 2012. And I have to go back a bit from that date because I started drinking late in life. And it was short, but it was powerful. It was not my first drink, though. My first drink was probably when I was 5. You know, Mom would let me sip off her daiquiri that her and the girls were having, or I'd get to take the cups in and I'd finish them off. Then as a young kid, teenager, I would make the drinks for them and always, you know, take the top off before serving the guests. But I never really liked it. You know, it was kind of fascinating to feel a little woozy, but I didn't like not being in control. And like many other of us here, my father was a raging alcoholic and was not a nice alcoholic. A lot of abuse in my story, a lot of trauma in my story. Alcohol taught me at a very young age that anger was very prevalent. And that when people blacked out or lost control, they would do horrible things to their children. And our answer as kids was to just feed him more alcohol, you know, because if we could put beers in his hands, then his hands were full and they couldn't beat us. But as we all know, the more we drink, the worse it gets. So I swore at a very, very young age that I would never become like my father. Never wanted to drink, never wanted to lose control. Fast forward a little bit to the high school years, and you know, it was the cool thing to do. Skip class, go hang across the street, pilfer some wine coolers. Bartles and James was big back in my day. Some of you laugh because you know. Boone's, Strawberry Hill, old school. But again, you know, never wanted to lose control. Never wanted to do anything. I just wanted to fit in. I wanted to be liked. So I'm sure you can see there's a pattern. There was a pattern coming here. And then I got busy. I got busy having kids. I got busy with life. And I kind of forgot about drinking because I was too busy trying to survive. I was a parent at 14. And then a parent again a couple years later at 17. And then got married at 18, as soon as it was legal, because my parents wouldn't sign off on it. Got married, you know, did everything backwards in life. And unfortunately, I married my father and very quickly got into the alcoholism with him, not me, because again, I was very against alcohol, but got into abuse and got into a bad road. And so I, thank God, survived that and made it out of it, but then realized that was what my picker told me to pick, was broken people. And got into another marriage, because let me just tell you, I love love. I love love. I love your love. I love your love. I love your love. And I'm going to find love, even if it's broken love. And so I'm an Elizabeth Taylor, just without the pocketbook. I think maybe I beat Elizabeth Taylor, but that's another story for another day. So second husband, no different than the first, you know, alcoholic, abusive. And then when I was sick and tired of being beaten, I would get out of it and find the next one. And by the third one, life was pretty unmanageable. I was working full time. I had three kids. Two of them were teenagers, and teenagers are a little rough. And I was supporting the household. And I was volunteering because I, you know, had to make up for all the trauma in my kids' life that I had created by being a 14-year-old parent who did not know how to parent. And so I would join all their activities, and I would be the teen mom, and I would be the Girl Scout leader, and I was on the PTA, and all the things that I thought all of you did. And then you guys would go have wine after, and I thought, well, I could do wine, right? That's not really alcohol. It's not alcohol. It's grapes. It's grapes. It's fruit. And woo, wine was good, and I liked it. And I liked how it relaxed me. And that stressful day of running the show for everything, taking care of the kids, taking care of the husband, because let's be real, he was a kid. And you know, supporting a household with not even knowing really how to function, I started drinking every day. And that would be my reward for putting up with a rough day. And of course it was manageable because I said, I'm not going to drink, right, until 5. I'm not going to drink until I get off work. I mean, I'm sure this is in the book somewhere. We try to manage our drinking. And then my kids would say stuff like, Mom, you're drinking so much. Why do you have to have, you know, wine every night? And, oh, I can stop it. I'll drink on the weekends. I'll manage this again. And so I saw a pattern happening here. You know, now I see the pattern happening here. But at the time, of course, I just think I'm controlling it. I've got this. I'm not an alcoholic because my father never could stop drinking. And he beat his children every day and his wife every day. And I'm not doing that, so I'm not an alcoholic. And then I would do things like go to wine events and be intoxicated enough that I probably should not have gotten behind the wheel, but you know, my mind told me I drove much better when I was drinking. I was, you know, it was like the video games I played. I could swerve in between cars. I could get to wherever I needed to go like that. Because I didn't really remember getting there. I just was there. Yep, and then that marriage fell apart. Because things got unmanageable. And so we jumped ship again. And number 4 found him up in Paso Robles wine country. Because we had to go to wine country, you know. And he liked to drink his gin and tonics. And I enjoyed my wine. And our neighbors were winemakers. And it was easy. It was easy. And he told me, you don't have to work. I'll work. And I went, wow, this is how life's supposed to be. This is it. I'm a kept woman now. This is perfect. I've been waiting for this all my life. Yes. I can do everything now. I can do it all. And I was leading Girl Scout meetings and on all the committees and hoity-toity, and everybody just loved me. I was the life of the party. But my deep, dark secret was that I was sneaking alcohol because everybody had told me I would get out of control. And so I would tell them, well, I don't drink. I don't, except for events. I only go and drink at events. And I'd have them in my center console. And they would be in my water bottle because I'd learned that if I drank Moscato, it looked like water. It looked like tea. And so people thought I was drinking tea all day. When really I'm drinking alcohol all day. And still didn't think I had a problem though, you know, because I was managing. I was high functioning. I was getting all the things done. I was doing it all. And it didn't matter that life was crazy and unmanageable. That's just how life is, right? That's how everybody is. And then I started becoming a 9 o'clock in the morning drinker, and wine wasn't cutting it anymore. It just wasn't giving me that effect. And all those ugly fears from childhood were starting to rear their ugly head on me. I wasn't feeling like I was a good enough PTA mom. I wasn't feeling like I was a good enough soccer mom. My kids were not wanting to hang out with me. My stepkids were constantly griping about my kids, and now there's dissension in between the husband and me, and It's your kids are doing this and your kids are doing that. And the only way that I could take the edge off was to continue drinking. And my tolerance became so big and so huge at this point that, you know, the boys were my friend, Jimmy, Jack, and Jose, you know, it was, I got my coffee cup out in the morning, my big 24-ouncer, we all drink Stanley's, which they weren't back then, because boy, I could have used one of those. I was tired of refilling, but I would do my tequila, my rum, my jet, and it was all alcohol. And then I'd throw a splash of grenadine in so that I felt fancy. Because truly, I hated the taste of alcohol, but at this point, I needed it. And so I'd wake up in the morning to get my day started, and that's how I started my morning off. You know, forget coffee, forget anything else, drink. And I would drive my kids to school like that, and I would do my teacher conferences like that, and I always was thinking about how to get my alcohol and not let anybody know I was doing it. And that got tiring really, really quickly. Really quickly, and as I'm sure you all know, we don't hide it very well. We think we do. We think we got it. It's, you know, in the closet, it's under the seat, it's any, and then we forget. We forget where we put it. You know, so we got to go get more. And I remember one night, I had already passed out a couple times and come to, and you know, I always use the excuse, I'm so tired from taking care of all these kids, you know, and I took the edge off and just slammed half a bottle of Milagro tequila, and my kids said, hey, Mom, I have that school function, and I said, let's do it. Everybody load up, and we hopped in the van and took off from Paso Robles to Templeton, and it was a pretty quick drive. As I was doing like 30 on the freeway, swerving to the center, and my 14-year-old is screaming, Mom, pull over, let me drive, and I'm backhanding her, stay in your lane, I got this. And then driving the kids home and forgetting to go back and pick up my kids. And my husband came home that night, and the kids ratted me out. Little suckers. Couldn't believe they weren't on my side. But they ratted me out, and rightfully so. And he told me, he said, that's it. I'm done. I've warned you. I've asked you. I've begged you. I've pleaded you. What is it going to take? You killing my kids? And he said, you figure this out or pack your bags and get out my house. And I said, well, what about AA? I've heard, you know, my dad used to tell me always about AA. I'll do it. I'll do whatever. And he said, sure, go to AA. So I walked into AA the next morning on a spouse card because I did not want what you all had. All right. I had seen it. My dad was part of your program, and that really didn't work so well. So I came into a meeting just like this, and I sat way back in that back row with the shakes and a cup of coffee and not wanting to make eye contact with a single person because I did not want what you had, because I didn't think you had anything for me. And these women walked up to me. Did they not get? I'm sitting over there like, you don't see me. Do not walk up to me. And they came up all happy and perky and, here, come on, welcome, here's my number. And it was like, you guys are so loud. What? On. Jesus. My dad never told me about this stuff. But y'all gave me your phone numbers. And at the end of that meeting, which I heard the person that was standing up here tell my story, and I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that she was literally saying everything I had just experienced for the last 8 years. And as I got ready to try to sneak out, y'all stopped. Christy, wait, you got the phone numbers, right? Yeah, I got them. Now you're going to come back. We have another meeting tomorrow morning. You'll be here, right? Yeah. Well, wait. Give me your number. Or better yet, wait. Where do you live? I'll come get you. So part of my character defects is that I'm a people pleaser. I want to fix all of you. And so I said, sure, yeah, here's my address. Come get me. I think I'm getting sick, though. You might not, you know. Anything to get out of it. Anything to get out of it. But I went because y'all showed up at my door and wouldn't leave me alone. And the reality was, is that if I didn't, I was going to lose my home. And I obviously didn't pick great men. My picker was very broken. I didn't even know how to pick me. I didn't even know how to love me at that point. So it was either figure this out and try to make something of what I got going on, or go drink and live in the gutter somewhere, because my family didn't want me, not at all. I mean, those were part of my problems, of my trauma of my childhood, is I came from a home that never got fixed. I came from generational trauma that never was healed. And all they did was throw Band-Aids over it and say, shh, we don't talk about that stuff. We don't talk about, that's family problems. We don't talk about that. We don't talk about our feelings. And I went in with these women who I wanted so badly for y'all to just like me, you know? But I had women issues. I had trust issues. I had big trust issues because, see, my mom never picked me. My mom really didn't even want me, you know? She showed me throughout my childhood that men are more important than children. You know, finding that next thing is more important than these beautiful lives that we create. And so I was very leery of all the women in the program. But I knew I shouldn't go find the men, because my alternative motive there was like, hey, you, hi. Because if this husband doesn't work, I need to come find you, you know, or you. Or in fact, I'll just both of you. We'll figure this out. But just don't talk to each other, okay? Because, you know, he talks bad about you, but I love you, baby. Yeah, I definitely did not know how to work life. I didn't. I was a manipulator. In fact, I am a manipulator. I'm a liar. I'm a cheat. I'm a thief. And I will burn you in an instant to save my ass. That's how I grew up. I'm a survivor. I don't want to die, so I will hustle to get what I need, to get mine, because you're not going to give it to me. You're not going to give it to me. And if you say you are, it's just to get something else. So I had to concede when I came in these rooms that I did not know how to do anything. I didn't know how to be a friend. I didn't know how to be a mom. You know, and I had 18-year-old children. I had an 8-year-old daughter who was begging me to get sober, and I couldn't do it for her. And I had to, you know, acknowledge the fact that while I wouldn't do it for them, I was willing to do it for this man. So fast forward, I followed rules well, you know. I followed rules well. I got told 90 and 90, and I'm a bit of an overachiever, so I did 180 and 90. You know, I gotta get that gold shiny reward. And slowly but surely, my head started to clear up a little bit, you know? But I still thought, I'll just figure this out long enough to where I can drink like a normal person. Because I'm not an alcoholic, right? I'm not my dad. Hadn't worked the steps yet. That's where it all came to light. And unfortunately, it wasn't miraculous and a beautiful story. I had a sponsor who told my fifth step at meeting level. No. Terrible, right? This is our utmost secret. Ones we don't even really want to tell ourselves. And I was mortified. I was mortified. But I had a choice that day. I had a choice to go boo-hoo and drink about it, or to show her, you're not going to break me. You're not going to break me. Because the reality is, this is not a wellness program. If it was, we'd all be cured and fine and not sitting in these meetings, right? So I held my head up, because that's what y'all taught me to do. Come back. Come back. And there was an old timer who told me, just because that person is sick doesn't define who you are. Okay? It's going to show you, this program will show you something, what you want or what you don't want. It's up to you what you pick. It's up to you. But you will get a lesson no matter what every time you walk in those doors. And so I said, all right, I'll persevere. I will persevere. And I found a new sponsor who was much kinder, much gentler, and took me through the steps and said, we're going to work this the right way. And we did. And it was painstaking. And it hurt. And it was scary. And it was daunting. But it's doable. And it wasn't as big as I had made it in my mind, right? Because I will make mountains out of the tiniest little molehill. Because in my character defects, I'm also a drama queen. You know, I mean, I want it to all be about me, but not really. Yeah, yeah. I want you to look at me, but not too much. And so when I worked the steps and I really got real with myself, I realized that, you know, that good old saying, all these lovely little colloquials up on the walls, they're there for a reason, you know? All those things that I didn't like in everybody else and was constantly going, was because that's me. And I can change that. I can fix that because there's a book that tells me how to. Tells me how to get out of myself. It tells me how to walk through hard things. And I'd love to say that that spouse card that I came in on, that he's waiting for me at home. Nope. He divorced me. And it's okay. It's all right. Because truly, that was not who I was meant to be with. And I did not love myself enough to give him what he needed as well. And he deserved a different version of me, not the broken one. And I deserved a lot better. So I made it through a divorce in my first year of sobriety without drinking. I figured out how to become self-sufficient, how to take care of my children. And I went through a custody case because, you know, the ex-husband that I had a kid with previously found out in my sobriety that I was an alcoholic. Little late, buddy. Where were you back when? And then he wanted to do something. In my first year of sobriety, he thought, well, now's the time to go back to the judge and say she shouldn't have the kids. And you all saved his life. Because I sat outside a courtroom as I lost custody. Because the judge said I needed to work on myself first before having children. And in my mind, I had just lost my child in sobriety. And I sat outside in my car with it running, watching him walk out the courtroom, and I thought, what do I have to lose? I'll gun it. I will run him over. He'll be dead. Win-win. I got three hots and a cop waiting for me, and she'll come visit. It'll be okay. Because she won't get stuck with him. And right as I was ready to drop in and to drive, the phone rang, and it was my sponsor checking in on me to see how court went. Because that's what you all do, right? That's what we do. We check in on each other. We're there for each other. When anyone, anywhere, reaches out the hand. I want the hand of AA to be there. And she saved his life and mine. And I am forever grateful. He doesn't know how grateful. I'd like to remind him, but he's still a little thorn in my side. And that's all right. He's a normie who doesn't have a program. So I feel sorry for those ones. I really do. See, I truly believe that this book should be handed out at birth. You know? Parents go, I don't have a manual how to raise kids. There you go. It's just an easier, softer way to live. Life got easier, and the promises started coming true. I started getting a career. I got my kids' respect back. I got time back with my kids. I got my own home. And, you know, I was being of service, and life was great, and COVID hit. And I told myself, you got sobriety under your belt. You don't need meetings anymore. It's all right. You don't want to sit on a computer anyway. You got other things to do. And if you're not like this, then there's just no reason to go. You got this. Because again, I have a sick brain, and my brain tells me crazy, crazy things. So I stopped going to meetings. I stopped calling my sponsor. I stopped being of service. And really quickly, life got unmanageable. And it got so unmanageable that I lost a job. I lost my home. You know, I as soon as I try to take control of things, I lose everything. Because see, I'm still broken. I'm broken. I'm beautifully broken. Don't get me wrong. I'm beautifully broken. But not a wellness program. And if I'm not working it, then I get sick really quick. For the grace of God, I did not pick up a drink. But life was nutty. All those character defects, manipulation, lying, stealing, cheating, they all came right back up. I mean, you're not cured, right? Nobody has said you're cured. We are recovering alcoholics. And my daughter, who is one of us, was very active in her addiction and alcoholism. She's a dual, which I could be too. I just never went down that road because I'm a chicken. And I co-signed on all of her use. I knew she was using, but it's easier to turn a blind eye than to confront that. And so I would just watch my grandkids and be like, mommy's busy. Mommy's working. Mommy's doing whatever. Where mommy's nodding out after being up for 21 days. Carpet surfing, you know. What are you looking for down there? Nothing. It's fine. I lost an earring. You don't have earrings. It's somebody's earring. Why are you judging me? She's fine, guys. She's just cranky. She's cranky. Right up until my grandson died, because she was too busy looking for that next fix to realize that her 2.5-year-old little boy was sick. And no matter how much I said, you need to go get him checked, she would tell me, I did, Mom, I did. It's fine. And I was supposed to believe that. And so I got this phone call at midnight, Mom, he's 104 degrees. And so my trade, by the way, I'm medically trade. And she said, what do I do? And I said, take him to the hospital. Why are you calling me? Like, well, no joke. She's strung out. She can't take him to the hospital. And for some reason that night, I just decided boundaries. I've got to have some boundaries. Because see, I have an 8-year-old at home that I'm trying to raise to not become one of us, which is very likely she will. It's a family disease, right? And so my daughter took him to the hospital, and because she was so worried about getting caught for being strung out, she left with him. And I went off to work because I figured, you know, here we go, co-signing. And when I got home, something in my gut told me, go check. And I showed up at her house, and she was in the back room, which is where she used. And my little five-year-old granddaughter answered the door and let me in. And I found my grandson, Blue, on the couch, barely breathing. And so I rushed him to the emergency room, and within 36 hours, he died. Now, I miss him more than life itself, but if one good thing came out of that, the only thing I knew to do to deal with the fact that my little grandson, Lucas, had just passed away, and that my world, as I knew it, was falling apart, was to walk into these rooms. That was all I knew to do. And I walked in, and I sat down in the little red house in Lompoc, just destroyed, because I blame myself. I can't tell you how many times I said to my daughter, what's it going to take for you to stop doing what you're doing? One of your kids dying? And so in my mind, right, again, broken alcoholic brain, I had killed him. I had asked God to take him. Guilt. Guilt, we tell ourselves crazy things. Crazy things. And I had to hold it together while everybody fell apart. Because that's what moms do. And you women saved me. You saved me. You brought me food because I couldn't figure out how to do anything but hold my babies and let them weep and keep a stoic face so that they had somebody strong holding on to them. And I'd like to say that it all worked out great, but it didn't. I nutted up and I thought, geographical, this is going to fix it all. Get out of here. Get out of here, because you cannot get her sober. And as long as you're living here supporting her, she will never get sober. And so I took off. I drove. I hopped in my car with my 9-year-old daughter. And I kissed my daughter and my grandkid goodbye. And I drove to the East Coast. Talk about moving as far away as possible from the problem. Oh, wait, that's right. I'm the problem. I came with me, guys. What? How did that happen? And I showed up to a town that, if any of you have been to North Carolina or know about North Carolina, it's very different. Very culturally different. Very ethnically different. It is just very different. And AA is like back in the old days, down in the basement of a church, smoke-filled rooms, and they crosstalk and they double dip, and they don't do it like we do it out here. Ooh, I showed up with a resentment. Y'all. Bless your heart. Bless your heart. I caught on to that lingo. I knew what that meant. I knew what that meant. But y'all told me to come back. And you guys smiled when I walked in the door. And you told me everything was going to be okay. And you let me cry. And you let me grieve my grandson. And you let me grieve the loss of my daughter and my granddaughter. Because as far as I know, they're still active in their addiction, and my grandbaby is still a casualty in that war. Because she doesn't talk to me. And the program has taught me that I have to hold my boundaries for my safety, for my sake, and my sobriety. I have to work my program. And my program is suiting up, showing up, being of service, and being an example. And I hope and pray she makes it into the rooms before another casualty happens. And that's my wish and prayer every day for her. And y'all taught me that if I got back into action and worked my steps again, that I might just make it out alive. And so I did. I jumped back into this program at 13 years sober with all the fever of I did when I came in as a newcomer. I went to 3 meetings a day, every day of the week. Because really, I had nothing else to do out there. I wasn't meant to be out there. It was just a time to heal. And my sponsor out there said, it's time. You need to go back. Your family's out there. Everybody is back in California. And by the way, all the wreckage of your past that needs to get cleaned up is sitting out there waiting for you. Really? Oh, damn. So I did. I came back. And I met all of you. And dang, I didn't want to. I did not want to be here again. I've been back since February of this year. And this is the best life I have had in a long time. In a long time. I have met amazing people in this program, both old timers and newcomers. Because see, my program gets something from every single person in this room. I don't care if you have 18 years or 18 hours, because everyone in this room has something for me. And I live by that, bless you. I live by it because for me, this is life or death. If I go back out and I pick up a drink, I will not come back because I will drink myself to death because that is the answer for me. So I don't want to. I'm not willing to play Russian roulette anymore with my sobriety. I've seen how not to do it. I've tried it, you know, I've been my own sponsor. I had a sponsee for an idiot, you know? My sponsee was an absolute idiot. And my sponsor had no good ideas. None. And then I met a woman who had the same story as me. And she's like, I did that. How's that working out for you? And I went, oof, okay, it's time to start doing it right, isn't it? When you're ready, we're here. And so I got of service. I started taking commitments so that I could be accountable. I started asking, how can I help you? I started handing out my number. I started being what I wanted back in return, right? Be the change that you wish to see in this world. If there's something in this world that you don't like, change it inside yourself. Spread it like wildfire. You all have this beautiful light inside of you. I've watched almost each and every one of you share your story. I've listened to you speak at meetings. I've gone and had fellowship with y'all after doing karaoke, dancing, going without shoes in Denny's. Because that's who I am. I fly by the seat of my pants. I'm an old soul. I'm young at heart. And you guys accept me that way. And God tells me that I am absolutely beautifully broken and that He never makes trash. And He made me for a purpose. And if that purpose was to stand up here tonight in all of my nerves and share with you how absolutely crazy some little girl from Santa Barbara could be and turn into this amazing, beautiful woman who wants to open her heart to each and every one, then I hope you got something out of it. So thank you, Kendall, for asking me to speak. And thank you all for suiting up and showing up for me. I appreciate you. Christy, I appreciate you.
Give Christy another round of applause.